podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Now, look back at the third day's play in the LV Insurance Test Series. Second Test, England, New Zealand, Edgbaston, and, well, last rights are upon England now. They're 35 for 9, effectively. A disastrous batting performance, which just actually was sort of demoralising in a way. You always, I suppose, begin Test Series with some hope, even though England have to field untried players and various people are not available. You still have some hope that someone will show some fight and some talent and some encouragement for the future. But with this performance, it was just devastatingly bad, actually, wasn't it? Would you agree?
Well, it felt like the bad old days, the 80s and 90s. England had lots of Saturdays like that 30 years ago, especially an Ashes Saturday. It reminded me of that, actually. What we become used to this England side being, you know, pretty strong in the 21st century. 20 years, they've sort of turned it round. You go back to 1999, that defeat at the Oval, England was sort of bottom of the pile, New Zealand winning that Test series. It sort of feels as if it's sort of come full circle in a way. The batting was so poor yesterday. It was astonishingly bad. There was technique. Resolve. I mean, England got themselves back in the game, and then it was just sort of frittered away. 122 for 9, and New Zealand on the verge of winning. Unless there's, you know, one of the great Test miracles. But I mean, even if there's a miracle, they're still going to lose. I mean, they're in that bad a situation going into the fourth, and what almost certainly will be the final day.
Yeah, I think I heard Phil Tufnell say on radio that when Mark Wood hit a six to put England into the lead, marginally, obviously, with seven wickets down, he said, well, if he does that another 20 times, we might have a chance. And I think that sort of, you know, put it into perspective, really. There was some hope with the way they sort of managed to annihilate the last few wickets after that long stand in the morning. But, I don't know, so often with 90 lead or something like that, you go into bowl again with quite a lot of optimism and expectation. And actually, Matt Henry, who's someone that is, again, like many of these New Zealanders, sort of underrated cricketer, the sort of super sub, they call him, don't they? And he's never taken five for in a test match, and he very rarely plays two tests in a row because they've got so many other fast bowlers they can call on. When he's come down to England to play for Kent, I remember one season he had something like 30 wickets at 8 or something after about 4 games. And he's just a master of making the batsman uncertain of what to play and what to leave, and getting a little bit of sort of waspish movement away from the bat to the right-handers, especially with the new ball. He's incredibly reliable, and he just took 3 wickets in a trice.
Yeah. Last time there was an Edgbaston Test match, there was a 90-run first innings lead, and the team that conceded that 90-run first innings lead were Australia, and they went on to win the game by 251 runs. I mean, there was no hint of England managing to do that with 85 behind on first innings yesterday. You felt actually they sort of did have a chance, strangely. They did seem to sort of drag themselves back into the game. They were slightly punished, though, by that last wicket stand of 27, which extended the lead from 58 to 85. And there was a sort of psychological element to it as well. Patel came out and played really well. You know, he actually dealt with Mark Wood, and those runs just gave New Zealand that extra cushion. And once Rory Burns went in the first over, I think Henry did bowl well. I mean, what they do is it's like their batting, isn't it? There's a sort of relentlessness about their bowling as well. They get the ball in the right place, and England combusted. Burns, who's been so solid so far, drove at one outside the off stump early on.
Confidence there, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, possibly.
Like he was still 80 not out or something, almost.
That's the thing. Sometimes, I mean, it can happen sometimes. If you're in good form, you actually play at that ball because you think, I can hit this through the extra cover for four or down the ground for four. If you're not such in good form, that's the perverse thing about it. You probably would have let it go. And it was one of those sort of, you think it's one of those sort of balls that Burns, in the first innings at Lord's, would have just let go outside the off stump. And then suddenly you're 0-1 in the first over. Sibley got out in that in the way they got out in the first innings. That's all the way you feel you can get him out. It's quite worrying, I think, for an opening batsman in Test cricket. Yeah. And then suddenly you're two down, and you really are under pressure. And then there's no Steve Smith to come in. I mean, that's what Australia had when they recovered that situation in the last Edgbaston Test match. They had Smith to come in that dire situation because they were in a similarly dire situation, but they were able to drag it round. So. One of the things we thought at the start of this series, is the potential for New Zealand and India to wreck England's Ashes plans. And there's been a lot of comment, Yoz, about, all England do is focus on the Ashes. And actually, what's interesting, of course, this time they have set their stall out to focus on the Ashes. That's exactly what they've done. They've recognised it as sort of the most important point in the calendar. And New Zealand and India are sort of staging posts along the way. But, you know, they could just get knocked off the mountain, trying to get to that summit along the way. And that's a big problem for them. Mm-hmm. They do have players to come back. But do they have the number of players to come back to turn around this team? I mean, that's the big question.
Well, I think there undoubtedly are. You know, Stokes, Butler, Wokes are, you know, fine cricketers. So that definitely will make a difference. Of course, New Zealand themselves were without Williamson and Southee and Watling in this test match. So that almost balances it out, really. And I think the mistake that England make about focusing on the Ashes all the time is this time, you know, usually, certainly for most of the last 20 years, Australia were the best team in the world or one of the best two teams in the world. So to focus on the Ashes was fair enough, but now they're not. Now New Zealand and India are the top two teams, the test teams in the world, so should be focusing on them to see how we compare. And I guess, you know, I've written a piece for the Sunday Times, and I've sort of tried to focus on pitches a bit and the fact that English pitches are not great, and it's reflected, that is county pitches, and it's reflected in the way that England have picked a sequence of batsmen over the last 5 to 6 years, all of whom average in the 30s in county cricket. Now, they're not bad players, these guys. I mean, if you go through from Sam Robson, Adam Lythe, Tom Westley, there's so many of them that have been picked, including the current crop. None of them average over 40. In fact, the only ones that do are Burns and Pope, both of whom, of course, play at the Oval, which is a fantastic pitch, the best in the country, and Root, who's a class act. And all the others average in the 30s, and therefore they're not that good. And it may be a consequence of playing on not great pitches that they're not that good. But if you go back to England's test team in the sort of 80s and 90s, well, certainly the 80s, you know, the likes of Gooch, Gatting, Stewart, Atherton, you know, all those players were averaging 40 and even 50 in county cricket. Boycott, you know, averaging 50. In county cricket, and that's why they are able to play the substantial innings in Test cricket that they were. This bunch, just they're cameo players, most of them, and therefore you're going to get those collapses like we had yesterday.
And they're also young as well. It is worth bearing in mind. Crawl is 23, Pope's 23, Lawrence is 23. Brace is 24, Sibley is 25. So that that is true. They are in sort of relative infancy of their international careers. I mean, I suppose the problem is if you struggle so much, you end up not having much of an international career, and the selectors look elsewhere. I mean, I suppose that's the next issue for England is what they do from here. Do they jettison some of the players? Well, they will to some extent, or at least they'll take them out of the side because they've got one or two players to come back in. And Bracey, for example, will go out of the side. He has had a really chastening couple of test matches. I mean, really, really in the spotlight. both, you know, as a keeper as well. I mean, that's the other thing, isn't it? He's been, every time he's been on the field, every moment, every ball he's been on the field, he has been under tremendous scrutiny. Some batsmen come in and, you know, they field in the slips or they field it in the gully or whatever, and you don't really notice them. But with Bracey, you've noticed him just about every ball he's been on the field because he's in the game the whole time. Obviously, batting, you know, the focus is on you. And then when you're keeping as well, the focus is on you. And he dropped a catch yesterday that, You really want your keeper to take. And he's dropped a lot of balls in the game. The thing is, he's not that experienced, the wicketkeeper. No, and in a strange way, it's very odd how England got to the state where they had Bracey keeping and batting at number seven. It's sort of unfortunate set of circumstances, really. You've got Butler is your main keeper. There's Folkes, there's Bairstow, who I think, you know, is perfectly capable of being a wicketkeeper batsman for England. And if Butler weren't available and Folkes wasn't available, I would have Bairstow as my next, you know, definitely as my next, you know, number seven batsman. That was where he was doing quite well a while back.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I remember interviewing him when he brought his book out about his life about 2 or 3 years ago. And he said his ambition was to play 100 tests as keeper batsman for England. And he'd had 40 or 50, I think, at the time as a keeper. So he's had a decent career as a wicketkeeper batsman. And he's a class cricketer. And the circumstances that enabled none of those players to play with their being rested from the IPL, that is going to have to be looked at because it's totally destabilised England. I mean, you know, New Zealand actually haven't suffered that in the same way. Trent Bolt didn't play the first test, but their IPL cricketers have, like Williams and people like that, have actually been available. So, yeah. And Trent Bolt, obviously, in the second test. So it's a bit of a mess, really, isn't it? And England have cobbled together a team which has kind of revealed the mediocrity of county cricket, or at least the massive gap between county cricket and the best test teams. On the last podcast, we mentioned LV Insurance and ECB's £1 million hashtag Funds for Runs community initiative. We'll be using this part of the podcast each time to talk about a different project using the funding to do some really great work to help recreational cricket in this country recover and rebuild. Well, we need that, certainly. Next up is Stoke Newington Cricket Club in Hackney, who were the very first recipients of a Funds for Runs grant. As the first, they were surprised by England and World Cup winner Anya Shrubsall joining a club Zoom call to tell them the news that they'd received a grant to set up a summer-long programme of free activities aimed at attracting women and secondary-age girls in inner-city Hackney to take up cricket. The funding will go towards a number of weekly sessions on Hackney Marshes, which include integrating mums at the same time as junior sessions to help battle a lack of childcare. Mums and daughter softball cricket sessions for beginners, outreach sessions for secondary age girls, and friendly festivals for all on Sundays. And that's a great initiative, actually, because, of course, 80% of primary school teachers are women. And the more women and girls we can get involved in cricket in some way or other, the more they'll teach their pupils at schools, at primary schools, to play cricket. So that's great for the game.
I was at Stoke Newington Cricket Club not so long ago, actually, a few weeks back. It's a really great facility, and there aren't that many cricket clubs around that area. It's on a lovely day. It's a really nice place to play. Well, we've talked about England's batting in this test match. What about their bowling? What New Zealand have been able to do in both tests, and who knows, if the rain hadn't come in the first test, they might have been able to go on and build a really strong position in that game and go on to win that match as well. New Zealand got similar scores in both test matches so far, the high 300s. I mean, normally in England, it's quite tricky for batting. And what we've seen so far this summer is two quite dry pitches. And England have said they want to play on dry pitches in preparation for the Ashes. I wonder whether it's slightly negating one of England's strength. You know, you talk about home advantage. We saw it in India in the winter, that very clear home advantage where they've got gun spinners and then they won down in the series and then bang, the pitches really started to spin. And you think of English conditions, you think of, you know, greenish, dampish sort of pitches possibly. And that has helped English seam bowlers, English pace bowlers. Of course, New Zealand have got them as well. So you know, you take a risk if you do that. How have England bowled in this Test match? Anderson only one wicket. Lower order player Neil Wagner, lots of overs, but only one wicket, and he's been quite skinny on wickets in this series. Broad with four, and then Stone yesterday picking up a couple, and Wood as well, back-to-back Test matches. How have England bowled?
I think Broad's been excellent. I really thought he bowled superbly in both innings and was unlucky not to take more wickets. I think Anderson, and by the way, Broad's speeds have been as good as he's ever had. I mean, he's been bowling 87, 88 miles an hour, so nothing wrong with him. Anderson also, his speeds have been pretty good. I've been watching that to see, because I know Nick Compton, amongst others, was sort of saying, is this the end for Anderson now? And I was looking at the speeds of 84, 85 miles an hour consistently. I don't think he's getting quite as much late movement, perhaps, especially not the in-swinger. I think the out-swinger is all right, but his in-swinger and his bowling across the left-handers doesn't seem to be swinging quite as much, though I don't think England had a particularly swingy ball, actually, in the first innings. I think he's bowling a few more loose balls, actually. He's bowling a few more half volleys. That may be an attempt to try and pitch it up a bit more. But he's certainly been hit for a few more boundaries than perhaps he would have been used to in the past. So perhaps his control isn't quite as good. Wood, excellent, I thought. It's not a pitch for him, this Edgbaston pitch, but he showed at Lords that he has the firepower to get the ball up to 94, 95 miles an hour and hurry the best players. He's not a bowler for a line and length, but he certainly has that X factor and extra pace. And actually, I really enjoyed his batting in both innings as well. Ollie Stone, yeah, he's all right. He hasn't quite got the pace of Wood. He does get quite a bit of movement, but he's not as accurate. So he's not as accurate, sorry, as the sort of Broad and Anderson. So, he's good. Overall, England's bowling was fine, I thought, actually. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. They didn't bowl too many really wicked wicket-taking balls, and they were confronted by excellent batting. You have to put that into perspective as well. All the New Zealanders were very determined with the bat and had great orthodox techniques and were hard to prize out.
So really, it is the batting. In a way, New Zealand's run scoring, the first thing, was sort of about par, the sort of scores you'd expect on that surface. But it was England who underachieved with the bat. And one of the players who really helped New Zealand along, and it was a really tough struggle for him at the start. It's looked a struggle for him, actually, in this mini-series. Ross Taylor, so experienced, 37 years of age, over 100 test matches, averages in the mid-40s, and we are going to give him the award for the day.
Yeah, we are. The LV Insurance In With Heart Award definitely goes to Ross Taylor, not just for his contribution in the third day at Edgbaston, but just for his commitment to the cause generally. I notice that even age 37, after 100 tests and 230 one-day internationals, he's still working on his technique. He has a bit of a vulnerability as an LBW candidate early on because he plants his foot and his head. His head slightly tilts over towards the offside and he sometimes falls over. So all bowlers try and get him LBW. He's still working on little tiny sort of changes, alterations to his trigger movements to try and align himself better. And once he got through that difficult early period in his innings in this third test, in this second test, he started to flow, playing some beautiful shots, lovely drives, cuts, pull shots. He's got so much courage and commitment, and I just love his attitude to the game, that even at 37 he's trying to improve and dedicating himself to the New Zealand's cause. So he's a very worthy winner of the In With Heart Award today.
And what he did as well, and what very few other players have been able to do in the game at the top order anyway, we've saw some shots from Wood and lower down from New Zealand Patel, is actually take the attack to the bowlers. What they did yesterday, New Zealand, in that first hour was really disrupt England. There were 60 runs in the first hour, everyone saying, three overs to the new ball, and Anderson Broad took it. But Taylor was on the charge and sort of putting the pressure back on the bowlers. I mean, eventually, it was a high-risk strategy. Eventually, he was dismissed, another batsman going in the 80s. And that was sort of when England had their chance in the game. And Stone very nearly picked up another wicket. He had a catch dropped. I thought when Mitchell was out to Stone after lunch. That was a really big wicket, and England were beginning to work their way quickly through this New Zealand batting lineup. Well, one thing we should say as well is it's not quite New Zealand A, but there's a sort of aspect of it about this team. You know, they've made six changes for this game, and their batting lower down the order looked a bit thinner, and so England were able to make progress, which is why I thought they were right back in the match. Let's have a look at the who's winning graphic. Well, we know who's winning now. New Zealand are right up there. But let's have a look at the progression of the match, Yoz, and see where England were when they started their second innings yesterday, how much they were back in the match. I mean, I think
the lines kind of crossed over here in the around the tea interval, just before tea, on the third day, where New Zealand lost their last few wickets quite quickly and England were going back into bat. And actually, the odds on winning the game then were about 50-50. And so as soon as England lost those early two wickets, suddenly the England blue line began to slump and the New Zealand black line began to climb, and it just went in those inexorable directions from there on. And I felt... You know, poor old Joe Root was stuck there trying to resist and stay in and try and help the younger batsmen up the other end. But they weren't in long enough, really, for him to help them at all. And in the end, he played a rather forlorn cut shot himself and departed. And England's blue line plummeted to near zero.
It's funny, actually. I was watching Root bat against Patel, and we all saw how brilliantly Root batted in the winter against spin, first in Sri Lanka, and then that double hundred against India. And I thought, well, is Patel really going to cause Root many problems on this pitch? There is something there for the spin. That's not a huge amount. I thought, no, he won't. But of course, even Root, going for that cut shot was just a bit of extra bounce from Patel. Even Root, you look at it, and he would have been desperately frustrated as he walked off. I do wonder about it almost has been the sort of perfect storm for England and Root in this test. There's all sorts of reasons. I wonder whether Root found the whole tweet situation very, very distracting. Something that's you were talking earlier in the test match about clear mind as a batter, having a really clear mind. And I wonder whether that's, whether there's a distraction, isn't it? It's a huge distraction there in the background.
Definitely.
And whether that's been a bit of a factor. And, and the fact he hasn't got the team he wants. The fact that New Zealand are strong. It's all sort of gone against Root, really. And it's been a really couple of chastening weeks for the England captain.
It has. I think he will cause to review his and presumably Silverwood's decision not to chase the target at Lord's and just play that, even if they hadn't got there, just to show a bit more purpose and initiative and be busy at the crease, would have sent a really good message to the rest of the team and also to New Zealand. Instead, New Zealand sort of saw that timidity, that almost fear, really, and thought, well, these guys are there for the taking. It's such a contrast to the one-day side, and the New Zealand influence on that, from Brendan McCullum to Owen Morgan, and the fearlessness that they played their cricket with, which just took them to the top of the tree in world cricket, and obviously to the World Cup win as well. It is so much about attitude, and I think it comes from the top in the end. And I felt it was very uncharacteristic of Joe Root, the attitude of England at Lord's on that last day. And it's probably still sort of infiltrating them now. So they do need a change of mindset, which a Stokes or a Butler or even a Wokes will help with.
A cynic would say, when you look at England's batting yesterday, you can understand why they didn't chase or try to chase the runs down at Lord's. They would have fallen in a heap. I mean, I think where England not chasing at Lord's, or not being a bit more proactive at Lord's, I'm not saying they necessarily won, but it would just put a bit of pressure back on the New Zealand bowlers. Yeah. And it just shows where this England side is, this particular England side. I mean, it's not quite England, is it? It's almost sort of half England A, but then they're sort of almost half playing New Zealand A as it is. It's a strange test match, this one. You don't normally see so many players missing from either side. But I mean, Test match cricket, I suppose, has become, especially in the COVID times, has come a bit about bench strength and mixing and matching a bit. And perhaps Test cricket in general, players are rotated, rested a bit because of the demands of international cricket. I mean, there's been a lot of anger about England's team selection for this Test match. Where are X, Y, Z? Why are they not playing? Someone like Chris Wokes, poor old Chris Wokes, who's barely played any cricket for since the end of last summer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary. He is centrally contracted. Mm. And he's hardly played at all. It does seem really odd how they've got to this situation. I mean, you can break it down and explain it logically, but so ultimately, at the end of it, it just feels really weird. The reason he's not playing, and just very quickly to go back to it, the reason he's not playing is because of I being in the bubbles the whole time, IPL bubble, and then that feeling of, would he have had enough bowling? You need to have that sort of consistency of bowling week in, week out to be ready. You don't want to suddenly be thrust back into a Test match and then break down injured because you just haven't had that workload. That's essentially it. But it does seem really odd that he's not playing. Stokes, you can understand. Stokes has got a broken finger, just to remind everyone about that. Jofra Archer is injured, and then there's Josh Butler. They said at the start, didn't they, that with the IPL they were going to let them play in the IPL. They took wage cut last summer. I think the quid pro quo was that players would be allowed to play in the IPL and make money in the IPL. And so they were sort of planning without Butler for this Test series. And, perhaps they wanted to have a look at Bracey. Perhaps they wanted to have a look at Folks, and that went wrong. And then Bracey has gone wrong as well. So there's sort of been a sort of perfect storm element to all of it, really, with the tweets as well. It's a tough time. And it does feel like some of those, it really does feel like some of those times in the 80s, 90s, when English cricket feels a bit all at sea. The challenge is somehow to turn that around. At least we've got some white ball cricket to focus on now after this Test match day. White ball cricket until early August. England tend to do a bit better at white ball cricket these days. How much that has turned around.
That's right. And there we are. I suppose the headline would be excellent New Zealand and England suffering the curse of the IPL bubble. We'll leave you with that thought as we say goodbye, and we'll review the LV Test series as a whole at the end of this match, which I think will come quite quickly.
Podcast Network.